Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stever. When someone dies, their relatives decide what comes next. Burial, cremation, we shepherd our loved ones to their eternal rests. But what happens when there's no one willing to step up? What becomes of bodies that go unclaimed? In America, more than 100,000 people go unclaimed each year. And a new book traces the lives of four unclaimed souls, seeking to understand whether they were alone in life as they became in death. The book Unclaimed examines both the bureaucracy and the relationships that led to the Office of Decedent Affairs in Los Angeles County to become responsible for David, Lena, Bobby, and Midge. It's a disturbing yet empathetic look at what we owe each other in life and in death. Joining us are the two authors of The Unclaimed, Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels, Pamela Prickett, a professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Stefan Timmermans, a professor of sociology at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So burial in a pauper's grave has been viewed throughout history as kind of a final condemnation on a life that was perhaps not well lived. It suggests maybe that no one loved you, that maybe your life didn't matter, but the stories you found were much more complicated. Pamela, what first drew you to this topic?
Yeah, so I will share with folks that this was not a topic that was on my radar. I hadn't thought about it until I knew somebody who was on the path towards going unclaimed. So I had been doing research in a mosque in South Central Los Angeles for many years. And one of the longtime members passed away. And at the time that she passed away, she was estranged from her family of origin. And her body was sitting unclaimed at the LA County Morgue. And the head imam at the mosque said, you know, the sister is going to be cremated. And then that was against the religious community's beliefs. And so members rallied together to raise funds to go to court to be able to claim her body and to provide her a Muslim burial. And then it got me thinking, what happens if you die with no family to claim you? And that's when I started looking into Los Angeles and the various bureaucracies that are involved and discovered this interesting agency called the Office of Decedent Affairs and learned that at that time, this is in 2015, there were about 1,500 to 1,600 people being buried every year in a common grave altogether in Los Angeles. And I thought, this is something I need to know more about, and I'm thinking will be something others will need to know more about.
So, Stefan, how did you come to get interested in this project?
So I have to immediately acknowledge that it was Pamela's original idea. Because she had more the personal connection to it. But I've been fascinated by deaths that fall outside our understanding of a good dying. You know, we have an understanding of what it means to have a good death, surrounded by families, being pain-free, hospice care, palliative care. And I'm interested in the deaths that fall outside that spectrum, like violent deaths, sudden deaths, unexpected deaths, traumatic deaths. And what I'm interested in is how do we make sense of these deaths? And with the unclaimed, what's really fascinating here is that we have this expectation that relatives will step up and organize a funeral. So you can't leave these bodies behind. What happens to them? So that's what drew me in into the topic.
Very early on in the book, you write that more and more Americans are ending up in what we have traditionally called potter's fields. And this includes people with homes, people with friends, even with living relatives who have been located. And that just absolutely floored me, Pamela.
I'll be honest. As I said, when I came into this, I didn't know much, but I had some expectations based on what I thought might be explanations. I thought it would be a lot of unidentified bodies, for example. Turns out in Los Angeles, those are rare. I mean, out of 1,600, 1,700, you might have, you know, 8, 9, 10 that are unidentified. So these are really unclaimed. And what the county determines is that they have tried to locate next of kin. And in most cases, they have a legal definition of next of kin. That doesn't mean it's always the right person to take on the obligation. And that In Los Angeles, they have these various agencies that are committed to locating Mexicans. So they're really successful at it. And yeah, a lot of the people do have living relatives. And as we explain in the book, there's a number of reasons in each case somebody doesn't step up, but there is a common pattern we found of family withered ties or family estrangement that helps to explain why sometimes after decades, it doesn't really make sense to ask that person to be claiming.
And you write that the number of people going unclaimed is on the rise. Stefan, what is your theory about why that is? Why are we seeing more people go unclaimed?
So the critical moment where a decision is made when you can go one way, being claimed or unclaimed, is when a government official calls you up and asks, "Are you going to make funeral arrangements for your next for the decedent?" And when people decline, that's the moment on which a person becomes unclaimed. And what we find, as Pamela said, is that often the people haven't been in touch with relatives, sometimes for decades, but on paper, they're still the next of kin. So what we're seeing is that one of the reasons that we see a rise in unclaimed is that families have changed tremendously over the last decades, and the government authorities are still focused on that one little box where, and once they find that box, they're not looking any further, and they ask that person, but so they don't take into consideration the quality of the relationship. So they overlook a whole bunch of people who might be willing to step up and organize a funeral, but they're never asked. And instead, they burden that one person who, in the chain of relationships, is the legal next of kin with that obligation. And so there's a bit of a mismatch between who the government thinks should take up that responsibility and who could be doing a better job.
Let me ask you both about Inez Gonzalez, who her nickname is Midge, because I think she's an example where the law perhaps hasn't caught up to the changing societal definition of family. When we meet her in your book, she's living in a van in a church parking lot, but it's her church. She's attended for years before she lost her home. And the people who attend services there, the people who work there, they like her. There's a family that even builds her a small apartment in their garage. So what happens to Midge?
Yeah, so Midge, I should say, is somebody that we decided to write about at length in the book, in large part because everybody we talked to was deeply affected by her death many years later, right? So readers of the book will come to understand that we meet a lot of these four individuals after, right? They've passed. And so we had to rely on the people who knew them in life to tell us about who they were. And Midge, yeah, everybody teared up when we asked questions about her. Everybody from that church community and even people from shared congregations that shared the same church space. And so Midge was, she was a complicated character in life, right? She had some strong personality tics that I think readers will, some of us will identify with. And she had strong opinions and she wasn't afraid to tell folks. But by and large, she was really deeply invested and immersed in this community. And so her health declines. And at the point that her health declines and she passes, there's this moment in which a scene investigator, a death scene investigator from the coroner's office, comes to that garage apartment that you described and starts looking at trying to determine what is a cause of death, first of all, and secondly, who's the right person in the state's eyes to claim Midge. And at the time, the church members say, because the pastor came, her best friend from the church came, they were in this in the congregation member's house, and they said, we'd be interested in organizing a funeral. But that's sort of the end of the story for them. At the next point that the county finds a legal next of kin, which is a niece in this case, who she hadn't spoken to in decades, that's the person who the county determines is tasked with. And so it's a really great example of this disconnect, as you pointed out, Anna, in terms of how the law is looking at this and who, who we actually spend our time with.
Yeah, because Stefan, the laws give preference to blood relatives or married spouses. No matter when was the last time you've seen them, it doesn't matter. If you are a blood descendant or you are still married to the person, you get to decide what happens.
Yeah, so this is one of the aspects of this study that really struck with me. I didn't expect this, but actually quite a few of the people we looked at, and we looked at more than the four cases, we looked at about 600 cases and chose and ended up choosing four, but quite a few of people have pretty good relationships to even very good relationships with ex-spouses. And they could or they might be willing to go and organize a funeral, but in fact they're just used as a source of information to come to the to go to the real next of kin. And there is a process by which you can go to court and file an ex parte and become the person who organizes the funeral and sort of, you know, jump.
Oh, I think Stefan might have cut out there.
So I'll pick it up for a second. So what he's explaining is that you can go to court and you can file this ex parte form. On the form, you're declaring that it's perjury if there is family and you're stepping in without notifying that family. So the county then in that situation kind of puts the burden on the friend, the chosen family to find out. And so I should just kind of go back and say that case that I came into this whole topic with was exceptionally rare. It almost never happens that once somebody is on the path towards going unclaimed, that somebody who isn't legal next of kin steps in and goes to court and gets that right.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about David Spencer? Because he kind of ends up in that situation with his ex-wife.
Yeah, exactly. David is another fascinating person, and this is true of all of those cases that we looked at. And a reminder that while we're writing about four people in detail, they represent a larger pattern in which there's just interesting stories in everybody, I would think, that goes unclaimed. But David is somebody who had kind of fits that loner stereotype, that archetype of I'm going to do life on my own way. He enjoyed living alone. He enjoyed, getting to decide how he spent his time without accounting for others. At the same time, he was pretty close to his ex-wife, who lived in another state. They spoke on the phone pretty regularly. And, she knew that he had passed because the apartment manager knew who she was and called and notified. Her name is Susan. And at the point that the coroner then calls to notify or to ask information to Susan that, there's sort of don't even give her the opportunity to say, would she be interested? Because at that point, divorce rendered her ineligible.
And Stefan, are you back? Are we good? Awesome. So
Yes.
your work also highlights the importance of having a will, because in David's case, he wanted Jesus, his neighbor at the apartment complex, to inherit his Rolex watch, but without a will, the watch gets sold at auction.
Exactly. And so here we're getting closer to what can you do about how can you avoid going unclaimed? And one of the clearest ways is to appoint somebody.
Oh no, I think we've lost him again. So I hate to keep going back to you, Pamela, but can you so
No worries.
yeah, so David's watch gets sold instead of going to the person that he really wanted to give it to.
So this is another way that I was surprised in the course of looking at the unclaimed. It's just not something I had considered. What happens to your stuff when you die if family is not involved in your disposition process? And what happens in Los Angeles County is that a different government agency, the public administrator, gets involved. They take an inventory of all your belongings, and then they go to auction, to public auction, to sell it off to strangers. Now, David had been close to Jesus, his neighbor, and the apartment building super for quite some time. I mean, Jesus was the person who would take David when he was physically unable to get to the store himself. Jesus was the person who would drive David. Jesus is the person who found David's body. But none of that mattered because there was no will. David was, according to Susan, David was really stubborn and didn't want to spend the money to get a will. And so, when he died, it's up to the public administrator at that point. And I wonder if people realize that how much the government is in your business if you don't have family and you don't have a will.
Yeah, one of the saddest parts of David's story, at least to me personally, is so There's this story you tell about his walking stick, which you say was probably his most cherished possession.
He had this walking stick, and on one of the last times that Jesus took David to the store to buy cat litter for the two cats that David adored, he left that walking stick in Jesus's car, and shortly thereafter, he passed away. And this becomes really symbolic to Jesus and to the apartment manager, Diane, about, remembering David, because they're cut out of the process. And we should point out that David died with money. And so if you read the book, you'll find there's a very different kind of ending for David than would happen if he didn't have assets at the time of his death. But, Diane and Jesus were not included in any part of that disposition process. So they didn't get to go to his funeral. And all they had left of him was this walking stick. And then, Jesus passes, and then it gets passed on to Diane, who passes on to her daughter. So it's this beautiful symbol that David still lives on to a certain way through this, this object that helped him walk.
Coming up, we're going to explore how to bring a person to life on a page when they've already died. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the growing number of people who die each year and whose bodies go unclaimed. A new book explores why it happens and perhaps what needs to change in our legal system. It's titled The Unclaimed: Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. Still with us are the book's authors, Pamela Prickett, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam, and Stefan Timmermans, a professor of sociology at UCLA. Stefan, you devote a section in the back of the book to describing how this project came together, and it does not sound easy. Officials weren't initially cooperative. How did you convince folks to come around and to open up to you?
So this is one of the challenges, and actually also the rewards of doing this kind of study, is that what makes the unclaimed interesting makes them also very difficult to track them down and track down their stories. I mean, many of those people have been invisible in life. They have been isolated themselves, or they've become isolated over time. And so to retrace their steps, we had to go and talk to the people who in fact declined to bury them. And so that took a lot of knocking on doors and doing some genealogy research to even find the right people. And that's when we discovered that there are people who actually did care about these diseases, but were never asked to organize a funeral. And then with the bureaucrats, the government officials, there's a lot of different agencies involved in aspects of going unclaimed, and it took a lot of trust building. It's being persistent in terms of even finding out something really basic: how many unclaimed are there? Because they actually are housed in different agencies, and only one agency provides official numbers. But for instance, one of the things we discovered is that there are veterans who go unclaimed. But because they are veterans, they end up with a military funeral at Riverside National Cemetery. But for all intents and purposes, they also were unclaimed, even though they will not be buried in that mass grave in Boyle Heights in December.
Pamela, you were granted some pretty extraordinary access, and you, I think it feels almost like you really breathe life into the four people that you chose to portray. And it's work that took you guys, what, 8 years, I believe, to complete. I guess, how did you find like the dedication to spend 8 years learning such, like, it feels as strange as it sounds, even though these people have died, it really feels like you know who they were.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. It took a lot of effort. And it took, you know, we're really grateful to the people who did speak with us, people who knew the four individuals that we write about, Bobby, Lena, David, and Midge. We're grateful to the family members who were willing to talk with us. We're grateful to the government officials. It didn't always make it easy to talk to them, but they did talk to us. So that all of that was really critical to be able to tell these stories and to get at, you know, what is happening in Los Angeles and the larger country. I think at some point, you know, it started out as a sort of a fact-finding investigative mission. And then at some point it turned into something where it really felt like we were obligated to tell these stories. I felt really compelled to continue and to do justice. And I, you know, I think if you read the book, you'll appreciate the statement. I became really emotionally attached to the four individuals. I care deeply. I care deeply that their stories are understood and told and how they represent for me, you know, many, you know, as you said, over 100,000 people every year in America who have stories worthy of telling, but don't get told.
Stefan, there's this belief from ancient Egyptians that we die twice. First, when we take our last breath, and second, when our name is spoken for the last time. And I sort of wonder what you make of the unclaimed in a broader sense. Like, it's such a hard idea to wrap our head around that like no one seems to care enough that you died to bury you.
That's true. And what the unclaimed show us that is that your name might already be forgotten even before you die or right after you die. You might just be like a bureaucratic file that winds its way through the different offices until your remains are being disposed of. But at the same time, for the same reason, the unclaimed are also a call of action, call to action. They're a call on an individual level. What can we do in our own lives that we don't end up there? You know, what kind of steps can we take that we're going to be remembered? And what one of the take-home messages that doing this book has had for, I think I can speak for the two of us, is that, you know, it's not about all the stuff that you squirrel away in life. It's about the social relationships you have, the kind of ties you have with family, with friends, that really is going to matter. But then there's also a wake-up call on a broader level, like what kind of society are we that we have these rising numbers of unclaimed? And is there something that we should be doing? And obviously, I mean, we shouldn't be doing something when these people are dead. We should be doing something when they're still alive. And so there's also a call to think through, like, why do we have so much social isolation? How can we address this? How can we change the law to be more responsive to broader notions of families? How can we restore a social safety net? This is the kind of questions that the unclaimed are. They hold up a mirror to us of this is your future. And you might be closer to going unclaimed than you think. These are not just the other people. These are us. If only one or two things go wrong in life, we might end up there. And so what can we do individually and collectively to avoid this fate?
Pamela, I think this is the perfect time for you to tell us about Lena Brown, because in a lot of ways, I feel as though she was gone before she died.
Yes, and in a lot of ways, not to be scary, there's part of Lena's story that I think would resonate with a lot of Americans. So Lena is somebody who grew up, established herself in a middle-class life, had a nice neighborhood, had a nice house. She, lived on her own after her husband died, and she lived many decades on her own. She didn't have children. And she got used to being very independent. And we could talk about why this is just such an American ideal, is to be independent, and this was really important to her. And at the same time, she lived a very long life, one that we all kind of hope to do, I think. And she got into her late 80s, and her body started breaking down, and she needed help. And at one point, her family does get involved. The courts of Los Angeles help them to get involved. But then, after she has a hip replacement, she needs to go into or hernia surgery, and then she needs to go into a nursing home. Slowly after that, her family stops visiting her, and she spends many years in the nursing home without a single visitor or a single call or card. And that's where she's at when she passes. And I just, when I think of Lena's story, it makes me really feel for all the people who are in nursing homes, who are in facilities, and they're alone.
Yeah, because her family ultimately decides that they can't claim her, even though they know she's in the nursing home. They help put her there.
They did. And to be fair, they put her in a nice nursing home.
Yeah.
They did their research. And they were involved in her life at the time that they did put her in that nursing home, and she needed full-time care according to doctors. So it's not that they were trying to get rid of her. It was necessary that she have that full-time care. But life takes turns, and the nephew who was really handling her conservatorship had some tragedies in his own life, and it became too much for him. And other family members decided, well, I don't really know her that well. So for me, one of the aspects of writing this book that was also a wake-up call is, in the past, that would not have happened. People felt an obligation. They were afraid of a stigma of saying no and letting a family member end up in a potter's field or a pauper's grave. And now we're finding people are more increasingly willing to say, yeah, it's not really important to me. So, I mean, if that's where America's heading, it's a monumental shift because, as you stated about, ancient Egypt, for millennia, we have seen this as a duty of the family. So in that way, I think Lena is representative of a larger set of questions that we should be asking.
Stefan, you reference other people who go unclaimed in the book that you don't spend as much time with. And one of the fascinating parts is when you describe how LA County handles dozens of cases each year where the deceased have money, sometimes significant amounts of money. Can you tell us about Robert Bradford? Because it was stunning to me. He had $1.3 million when he died.
Exactly. And so this is one of the ones that also blew us away. And just think, how can you really end up at this stage? And so he had a brother that he was in touch with on a very regular basis, which they would call on the phone on a, almost every week. And but when he died, the brother basically was mostly interested in the inheritance and let the county take care of a funeral, didn't show up, and that was the end of the story. And so the brother got a check for more than $1 million a year later, and here we are. Another person is unclaimed.
That, I don't want to pass judgment, but that feels so cold.
If you talk to the people who are in the medical examiner's office or the Department of Decedent Affairs, they will tell you how quickly the conversation goes to, can we get a death certificate so we can start getting the will and read?
I want to also talk about Bobby. He is the fourth person that you profile in this book. His name is Bobby Ray Hanna, and you describe him as probably the most likely of the four to end up unclaimed. Why was that?
Yeah, so readers will, we will open with Bobby's story. You will see Bobby about to read about Bobby about to sing on national live TV for America's Got Talent. He was doing well, and that was significant because it came after decades of struggle, at which point he was a veteran and he needed assistance, and he got into a program called New Directions in Los Angeles that helps veterans who are unhoused. He got, he was in this program when he joins the choir, and things are looking good. That's a situation where I have to say it was very clear to me that this program for New Directions was helping to turn lives around, and it worked for a while. Like a lot of people, Bobby had some health problems, and as things progress, he also had this tendency, and I think this is true. I think a lot of people will resonate with this. It's like, I don't want to be a burden on others. I don't want people to know that I'm suffering, I'm in pain. I want to be tough. I want to be strong and not show weakness. And he starts kind of pushing people away. And he did seem like somebody who was going to go unclaimed, although in the book there's some shifts at different points that suggest maybe that's not as clear cut as we thought at first.
Yeah, you have this great example in the book that he has these fancy boots that he likes to wear when he sings with the choir, and his health deteriorates to the point where he can't put them on, or he really shouldn't be putting them on. But he does, right? Because it's important to him that he looks a certain way when he sings.
So he would wait until the very last minute they were about to go on stage, and he would put these boots on, and he had had foot surgery. I mean, he could barely walk at one point, but got it, the pride. And as everyone said, he's a proud guy, and he wanted to look good, and so he put these blue ostrich leather boots on, and he had a car at one point to match the boots. So this was Bobby.
Yeah, and Stefan, his son Donnell, they didn't meet until Donnell was an adult, until later in life, and he really goes through a lot of indecision and strife about claiming his father. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so Donnell faces a bureaucracy from being far away in Indiana. I mean, he has to deal with what's happening in Los Angeles, and he just to the impression we got from talking to him is that he just does, everyone is the same, but we know these are all different agencies. They have different responsibilities and they have different kind of questions. But whenever he gets a call, he feels it's like the same kind of office that is calling him. So he's really confused about this, and Bobby's body has initially been transferred to a funeral home where the storage fees are exorbitant, and he's already facing this really high bill, and he thinks no, because Bobby's a veteran, the Veterans Administration should take care of everything, and that's really what he fixates on, that the VA should organize, do a cremation, and then ship the ashes to him, and so he really doesn't completely understand the system, but he's in the end is super persistent in terms of deciding what he wants. And what's really the beauty there is that, we explain this in more detail in the book, is that, even though Donnell himself is struggling, he has a lot of challenges in his own life. And he hasn't even met his father until he's an adult, he still is committed to being a family at the moment of death. And the thing that families do is claim their own and bury their own. And so, the odds are really stacked against Donnell being able to pull this off. But then we show in the book that, there's lots of twists and turns in the story in whether he is able to pull it off.
Yeah, and that, how do private funeral homes add pressure on families to make these decisions? Because it like the fees are racking up and up and up, and like Donnell is not a rich man.
Yeah, so that's a great point. So how's the funeral industry involved in this story? So we don't leave bodies to just decompose in the open, right? If it's on the street, the coroner comes in. If it's in a residence, then very often a private funeral home will be called, as happened with Bobby. He died in his vet subsidized apartment, And you know, the manager is like, we got to get this body out of here before it becomes an issue for other tenants. And so they call a local funeral home, which is part of a larger multinational conglomerate company that I won't say the name, but you know, it's they kind of take Bobby. And at that point, that Donnell said, okay, he had to approve it. So he's like, okay, I'm far away. What do I know? A funeral home, okay, take it. And then they start charging all these fees because they have the body. And Donnell feels that they're holding his father's body hostage by charging him. At one point, they quote him multiple thousands of dollars in storage fees or to do a cremation, to transfer it even to another funeral home. And that's when you know, he stops answering the funeral home's calls. And so I think, you know, we can appreciate why he felt that his father's body was being held hostage. And then what the funeral home gets to do is they get to call the county and say, you know what, I don't think Donnell is going to come through, so this should be your problem. And the county picks up the body from the private funeral home, transports it back to the coroner's office. And at that point, then, you know, the public administrator actually gets involved in trying to figure out what's going to happen. And so it's this interesting interplay between private interests and government responsibilities. And I just want people to understand, look, if people cannot claim for finances or will not claim, the government is going to step in. There's not an option to just leave the bodies.
That was Pamela Prickett, a professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam and the author of a new book, The Unclaimed: Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. Coming up, we're going to talk about the living, the men and women whose job it is to track down relatives and eventually bury those who go unclaimed. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the growing number of Americans who die alone and whose bodies go unclaimed by loved ones, with the government ultimately picking up the tab. A new book titled The Unclaimed: Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels profiles four individuals whose bodies end up unclaimed. Still with us are the authors, Pamela Prickett, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam, and Stefan Timmermans, professor of sociology at UCLA. I want to shift our conversation to the living, the county employees in your book, whose job it is to locate loved ones, cremate bodies, and eventually bury their ashes. When did you realize that their stories needed to be told as well?
So, again, this is not something we intended necessarily to elaborate on, but once you sit next to scene investigators, notification staff, and see the level of care they bring to this kind of task of notifying a remote relative that somebody had died, you cannot walk away unimpressed. And you know, when we went on scene investigations with some of the staff of the medical examiner's office, we realized these people have some of the most difficult and underappreciated jobs that you can imagine. So every call they get sent out on is going to be a bad story. Somebody died in really bad ways, and so they have to retrieve the body and do a scene investigation. And so we realize they are the unsung heroes, and they can just tick off the boxes. They can just sort of like, you know, remove the body, make a couple of phone calls, do their due diligence, and that's it. They're doing their job. But
what we noticed is how deeply caring they are, and sometimes also frustrated they are with both the bureaucracy and the reluctance of relatives to step up, or relatives focusing, as we talked about earlier, on the money rather than on the memories of the decedents. And so these are really they're toiling behind walls, and they're invisible in their offices, but they're really doing critical work. And we all want the best death investigation system, but we're often, from a government perspective, we're not necessarily willing to pay for that. And so bringing the critical importance of their job into the light is also one of the goals of this book.
Yeah, Pamela, you guys open the book with two county employees, Craig Garnett and Albert Gaskin, and this really jarring scene where the two men are wearing protective gear while essentially dumping boxes of cremains into what is a mass grave in Los Angeles. And I just had to put the book down after that. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to need a moment.
Yeah, so it is a powerful scene, and you know, we're going to have you bring you into the seriousness of the topic, and at the same time show you this humanity that, in this case, Albert Gaskin and Craig Garnett bring to that process. And these are two men who you come to know well over the course of the book. They've been working for the county for decades. You know, they're not making a lot of money, and yet they're showing up every day. They're not complaining. They're bringing dignity. They feel it is an important service that they're doing for Los Angeles. And, you know, it's for me, they're also the unsung heroes, right? And they're two of the people that I came to just cherish so much in the course of doing this work and writing about them. And, you know, Craig is somebody who, you know, he comes to the cemetery every single day, and he, you know, takes time to feed the squirrels peanuts in his pocket. I mean, it's just a little detail, but it's one that shows you that, you know, this is a person who cares. And I think, I hope that readers come through and see that there are good people behind these bureaucracies. Are they complicated? Are they messy? Are they frustrating? Yes, but there are good people who are working behind them.
You also follow the woman who has to pick up David Spencer's body. And one of the things I found so fascinating is the impact that being the person who goes and collects these bodies has on her day-to-day life, even down to, you know, whether she can enjoy a day at the beach.
Yeah, absolutely. Christina McGuire. Yeah. I mean, she's a death scene investigator. She's charged every single day with, as Stefan said, going out to the worst scenes of death. And she starts to have this kind of cartography of the city, right, through a lens of death, of the deaths that she's seen. And on that day that we describe David's death scene investigation, on the way out, I sat in the front seat with Christina driving there, asking her questions, coming to learn about how she ever came to this job. And then on the way back, I sat in the back seat and Stefan was in the front. And Stefan, you want to share some of the things she told you about, you know, the way she was seeing the city?
Yes. So she saw everywhere dead bodies that she had retrieved. So we would pass an old falling down house, and she would say, oh, there was a drug overdose. I wonder whether they ever solved what happened there. Or we would go past a water treatment plant, and she said, they pulled the body out of there. And so her entire view of the city were all kinds of bad, dead bodies. And that sort of affected her psyche too. Like, she saw danger everywhere. Like, when, you know, friends would be very happy on Facebook and posting about a new baby and put a picture on there, and the baby was like on its belly, she would go in a panic because she had been at scenes where babies had died. So she would chastise the parents and say, hey, you know, put that baby in the right way.
Yeah, and she even makes assumptions or has theories about the people whose scenes she's investigating, because it's part of her job, sort of look for clues. Like, when she goes into David's apartment, she's looking for information about potential relatives. She's sort of sizing up that it's clear he's probably not cooking, but he's got these like disassembled bicycles. So she thinks he's probably like a tinkerer.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that Death Scene Investigators look for, they call greeting cards treasure maps because they'll point to people who might care. And so she's very respectful, but she is sort of on a invest, she's a bit of a detective to try to figure out who is David Spencer. What did he like? Where might those greeting cards be? What's in the closet? She finds some interesting items in his apartment, which also there are police officers on the scene who comment. And she has this, the police officers, it struck me how they would just stand there and watch. And she's really doing all the work, along with an attendant who joins her later from the coroner's office. And I just want to add about Christina, one thing in doing this work every day that she brought home repeatedly to us on that day, later when we saw her in the office in follow-up interviews, is she sees death everywhere, but she also sees the value of life. And you set up this part of this show as it is about life. It is about thinking about the preciousness of life. And so, we heard the scene investigators tell us over and over, and Christina was really strong, that it is who do your family members know you love them? Are you living life to the fullest? It can sound cliche, but they have this beautiful way of thinking about making the most of life. And we share some of their sort of secrets, secret tips at the end.
Yeah, and you both write about your own personal relationships, like Pamela, you with your dad, or health scares, Stefan, and how they've given you both a deeper understanding about how it's possible to be estranged or find yourself without family nearby.
Yes, yeah, so in my case, I'm studying this, but I'm thinking these are other people. This is also probably what many of your listeners will be thinking, the unclaimed are others. And so at some point during the pandemic, I had a health scare, was rushed to the hospital, and my wife was out of town, and I have two dogs at home, and the doctor says in the emergency department says, we're going to keep you for 4 or 5 days. And I'm starting to think, who's going to take care of the dogs? And I look at my phone, and I don't really have that many people that I can call in the moment. And we've been writing about David being a loner and his social circle shrinking. And I'm thinking, the pandemic did a number on my friends. I need to make this a priority. I'm not that far away. I'm not necessarily of going unclean, but of that social isolation that undergirds this problem of going unclaimed. And so I definitely deliberately made a project of establishing, rekindling friendships, but also establishing new friends events. Like I have a dinner group. We go out every 2, 3 weeks, and it's done deliberately as a project. I need to keep these friendships and social ties alive because it's so easy over time to slide into a life where you think you're actually well connected, but in fact, you're not talking to that many people anymore.
Yeah, and if I could just add one part here about my story, Anna. So when I started this project, I sort of assumed it was going to be much more of a story about money than we found, in the sense that I thought it was everybody was going to say to me, "Oh, I didn't claim because of the cost." And I sort of came into it, I admit right at the end of the book that, I kind of came into it with a little bit of judgment. Like, if you have the money to claim, you should. Like, this is your obligation. And what I found in the course of writing this book is it's much more about estrangement than I had ever expected. And in writing about estrangement, I fell out of contact with my father. And, it's been extremely painful and hurtful. And I do think that a personal experience brings a newfound empathy in the that I brought to the writing of the book to understand it's not that simple anymore. What do we owe family? These are questions that are, historically specific, and they're due for some follow-up questions. Where does family end? Where does it begin, and where does it end?
That was Pamela Prickett, a professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam. Thank you so much for your time this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Stefan Timmermans, a professor of sociology at UCLA. Thank you.
Pleasure to be there.
Their new book, The Unclaimed: Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels, is on sale now. And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you.